Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to the Justice Visions podcast. I'm Brigitte Hermans, researcher at Justice Visions and your host for the coming episodes. In the previous episodes of this season, we addressed some of our recent and ongoing research under the banner of How Do We Talk About? But we are all in for change and we decided to test a new formula. We have a new mini-series that will take a deep dive into justice efforts for Syrians, which is my research project. And I'm really happy to announce that we are producing this series in cooperation with Habib Nassar, who is the Director of Policy and Research at Impunity Watch. Great to have you on board, Habib. This is a first for you, no?
Yes, indeed, Brigitte. I've actually never been on the side of podcasting so far. It has always been on the side of the interviewees, so I'm really happy to be behind the scenes. I think for Impunity Watch, this is a great opportunity to be part of a project that would give some additional space to our Syrian partners involved in justice efforts so that they can reflect on their work, share their perspectives and lessons learned.
Great. And which aspects of these justice efforts merit more attention in your view?
As you know, the road to justice in Syria was initially blocked. However, what has been particularly remarkable for us is the relentless and creative efforts through which Syrians have unlocked the road to justice. And this is probably the story that all of us, together with our partners, will be telling through this podcast.
Yeah, indeed. I think these are really the stories that remain all too often untold. And I was wondering, when you use the word justice in this context, you probably also refer to the Truth and Justice Charter, the charter that was launched in February 2021 by five victim and survivor organizations. But how do they define justice, actually?
Indeed, they do, in fact, distinguish between justice as long-term justice, which is the case, for example, for judicial accountability, and then justice that would address immediate needs and demands of victims, like the release of detainees or revealing the fate of the disappeared. And in this case, it would be short-term justice. So this series, I'm hoping, will look at both long-term justice efforts, but also short-term justice. There are ongoing efforts by the victims and the families associations and other Syrian NGOs today to establish a process to search for over 100,000 missing and disappeared in Syria, which is an effort that led the UN General Assembly to adopt a resolution back in December requesting the Secretary General to conduct a study on the issue of the missing in Syria. And this is an example of, I would say, short-term justice efforts.
Wow, that was a lot to unpack. Great to hear that you're so enthusiastic to share all of this with us now today. But of course, we will address several of the issues that you've just touched on. But I think it's really important that you did mention the fact that one of the reasons why we're doing this joint Impunity Watch Justice Visions podcast, of course, is exactly this justice activism by victim groups, by so many humanitarian and mostly human rights organizations. I'm really happy that one of the important also human rights activists is here with us today, or for the next podcast season will be with us. Welcome, Mohamed Abdallah, also known as Artino. Welcome. It's nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much, Brigitte. Thank you, Habib.
So maybe it would be nice to tell us a bit more about your background and your interest in the podcast, Artino. You are a Syrian photographer and a human rights activist. Currently, you're also working as a communication officer for the NGO Women Now for Development. Can you give us some more background about your interest in justice efforts?
To be honest, it's really important for me as an, not also as a Syrian, but as an activist who was on the ground on a time when the uprising started in Syria, taking pictures and collecting these violations or even crimes that have been committed by many, many parties, but also seeing now with these recent years that this effort that's going on more and more into courts, and these efforts are being more collectively brought to the surface, as I would say. I'm really happy to participate in this project, as the victims group's efforts really deserve more attention. And the podcast is really very timely in a view of discussion about the mechanism of the missing and the disappeared. But before we start exploring this, Brigitte, you might want to tell us what drives you to set up this project.
Yes, I would be happy to share a bit what I'm doing. So for the last 2 years, I've been examining justice efforts for Syrians in the framework of my PhD research project. This project is quite ambitious in the sense that it looks into how artistic expressions can potentially open what I call the justice imagination for Syrians. Because when we look at justice for Syrians, a lot of people think or estimate that justice is impossible because of the lack, as Habib just explained, of avenues, for example, such as the International Criminal Court. But then when I started out to research, I got really absorbed also by the civil society's justice efforts, because these, I think, have been really strong and unmatched to a certain degree. And the way in which Syrian and international justice actors adopted the transitional justice toolkit is very innovative. So I think that the whole justice debate is meriting more attention. But especially the activism, like what activists have managed to do despite the complete international indifference or justice fatigue, etc. And also understand that the possibilities to advance justice in the absence of a transition and multiplication of perpetrators is really quite groundbreaking. And of course, when we look into the situation in Ukraine, for example, today, we see that it brings back a lot of these debates on justice, on the persecution of international crimes, which are happening in the Syrian context, but in a completely different way. So I think it's important to show also that there is ongoing resistance.
Well, indeed, to be honest, there is a lot of things to discover and unpack in there. And that's what we get to cover and go through this course of this session.
Well, we're also quite ambitious in this project. What we actually wanted to do today is to give an overview of some of the main justice efforts to set the scene. And in the coming episodes, we'll address the limits of criminal accountability, victim groups' realizations, truth-seeking, and the role of artistic practices.
In this episode, I just wanted to add that also we're going to analyze the efforts to overcome the accountability gap and the justice impasse, as you call it. But beside hosting these episodes, I may ask you from time to time to share some of your reflections as a researcher. So as a start, I wanted to ask you about what do you mean by the justice impasse?
Well, I think it's a word that is really apt in the Syrian context, where we see that the whole justice system, the criminal justice system internationally, is failing. There's a blockage of the International Criminal Court because of the Russian and the Chinese veto. But there's also no effective multilateral initiative to stop the crime. There's an ongoing impunity that has more or less been accepted.
Habib, you have been involved in these endeavors by NGOs. We don't have the scope to look into the history of this justice mobilization in the Syrian context, but I would like to hear from your perspective on this major development that shaped the transitional justice process.
You know, from really very early on, and together with major documentation work by Syrian civil society actors, Syrian were really trying to reflect on how justice would look like for their country. However, initial justice work was assuming that the political transition will happen very quickly, and that transition and justice institutions such as a truth commission or a court or a reparations program would be established in Syria. And sadly, you know, at this early moment, international institutions really, instead of encouraging Syrians to reflect on what would be the most adapted to their context, because at this stage, no one knew how and what the transition would look like. So it is difficult really to envisage a specific plan for transition and justice when we don't know if and when a transition will happen, and if it was to happen, what would be the dynamics of this transition?
Maybe just to come back to the transformative aspect, because it's really interesting to consider how this holistic approach was forcibly abandoned and a new approach, which was maybe more pragmatic, was adopted. Let's zoom in on the relevance of transitional justice, because of course there's much more criticism also coming from actors on the ground, civil society actors. How relevant is transitional justice still today for justice efforts in the Syrian context?
I think that, first of all, the whole field is evolving, and probably developments in Syria are contributing to this. In the absence of any prospect of immediate regime change and transitions, what the Syrians and those working with them and supporting their efforts really did is to deconstruct a little bit this so-called toolkit and use it more as a framework, a rights-based framework, I would say, rather than a sort of a blueprint for justice. And this is how Syrians and their partners have started to invest, for example, in a universal jurisdiction, because they saw there an opportunity to advance the right to justice and accountability.
You used a word which is very familiar, I think, to a lot of us, universal jurisdiction. But could you maybe briefly elaborate what universal jurisdiction is and why it is relevant in the Syrian context?
This is a special form of jurisdiction that exists in a number of countries in the world, especially in a number of European countries like Germany, like France, for some specific crimes like torture, that allows these countries to retain their jurisdiction when they are confronted with very serious crimes, and more specifically with war crimes and crimes against humanity. Of course, the condition of universal jurisdiction in each context is different, and there is no one single regime. But what happened is that a number of Syrian activist human rights lawyers, together with the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, have initiated a case that has become to be known as Al-Khatib case.
Thank you so much. But we will explore criminal accountability and its limitation in the second episode. Yet, I would like to ask you briefly about the main takeaways as Al-Khatib trial presents a milestone that we need to touch upon.
The Al-Khatib case was a case brought to German courts. And as you know, in Germany, we do have universal jurisdiction for war crimes and crimes against humanity, which allowed the prosecutor to take this case to Syrian officers from the Syrian security services who were present in Germany, were arrested and tried. And a verdict was delivered against the two. A first verdict last year that sentenced one of these two individuals to 5 years in prison, and then landmark judgment back in January 2022, convicting Mr. Anwar Ruslan of crimes against humanity and sentencing him to life imprisonment.
Why at this time, this trial of Anwar and with Al-Khatib trial, why is it so important at this time?
Probably because really for the first time, a senior official from the regime is convicted for crimes against humanity through a fair trial taking place not so far from, I would say, Syrians, because it took place in Germany. And I think it did allow for the involvement of many victims of serious crime in Syria in the trial. And I think it is probably laying the groundwork for other cases. There is already another trial that has actually started in Frankfurt of a doctor also involved in torture cases that started at the end of last year. So in the absence of an ICC referral, in the absence of domestic trials, I think this is certainly, even if very limited, and even if not addressing all aspects of justice and short justice, I do think that a lot of progress is being made through this case.
It's interesting that you mentioned the short-term and the long-term justice again, because, of course, one of the main issues that we want to discuss is indeed justice efforts led mainly by victim organizations or increasingly by survivors and families. Yet the bulk of the analysis and the interest for justice efforts in Syria has focused on the work of institutionalized NGOs or even on international institutions. Yet it is remarkable because a lot of the advancements and progress and also the disruption, let's say, in the field of justice efforts has happened on account of the efforts of victims. How did this activism come about so suddenly?
I don't believe really it did happen that suddenly. It's probably happened as a result of a long process that was taking place behind the scenes and that we could not seen, because many of those who were behind this movement, when efforts to bring justice to the victims had started, many of those were still in prison, or many of the families of the detainees or the disappeared were still inside the country. They were already leading efforts domestically to secure, for example, the release of the detainees. What probably happened in this past, let's say, 4 to 5 years is that groups of survivors and families, for example, the detainees and the enforced disappeared, they have started to organize. And we are seeing a movement emerging for this. And I think that the emergence of this movement is probably should be seen also as an effort to adapt to the very complex Syrian situation that leaves very little space for the traditional and usual justice approaches. So as for the universal jurisdiction case, I think there is a lot of creativity in this movement, trying to take advantage of small windows of opportunity, really to push for example, a solution for the crisis of the detainees and the missing in Syria.
So maybe it's also interesting to zoom in on how the Agency of Victim Groups also created the momentum in the international framework and also concretely in the General Assembly. Could you briefly inform us about what exactly happened at the General Assembly and how this ties into the mechanism for the missing and the disappeared?
First of all, many of the victims and the families realize and obviously were supportive of that. A lot of the efforts were being invested in criminal justice while there wasn't enough attention being given to the fate of the disappeared, by their peers in the Syrian civil society, but also by international policymakers. So it is very clear that as a result of this effort, the issue of the detainees and the enforced disappeared in Syria is today part of the international agenda on Syria. And really what illustrates this very concretely are several statements made by the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights on this issue, the Syria Commission of Inquiry, the UN Secretary General. And this all culminated in a resolution by the UN General Assembly back in December, really insisting on the importance to address this crisis and asked the Secretary General to prepare a study and propose ways to boost efforts to address this problem.
I suggest that we leave it here. You probably feel that you have barely scratched the surface. But let's hear a take of two practitioners on the main development. Brigitte, you spoke to Maria Lab, the director of Women Now for Development, and Mazen Darwish, director of SCM.
Yes, indeed. So I asked both Maria and Mazen about the ways in which Syrian civil society has attempted to overcome the obstacles to justice or to accountability, and also the main achievements that they believe that justice actors have accomplished. And lastly, also their perspectives on future justice efforts.
Let's start with Maria Al-Abdi. You have asked her about the ways in which Syrian activists have overcome these obstacles to justice.
Actually, there is a lot to challenges to overcome, but hopefully we have been able as Syrian civil society to do some good job, I hope, based on different expertise, field of work or access. Syrian civil society actors have been playing role on advocacy, on keeping the narrative of victim alive, especially when some countries are speaking about normalization. They have been working a lot on documentation of a human rights violation and to make this document available for trial, to support trial. Also, as an organization like us, we are not experts on accountability at all, our work was more to support victims, to ensure that marginalized victims have access to justice, support victim and survival groups, documenting stories, not only the violation, but also the stories and the narrative of the victims. Also, I would say understanding what justice means to members of society that are often marginalized from formal justice process, like women. Our advocacy became more broader than only accountability. We try to think about mechanisms that support everyday justice and that support transformative justice so the horrific crimes don't have any background on the future.
What's interesting is when we look into the achievements of Syrian civil society, Mazen insisted on the importance of documentation and also the speed that Syrians adopted in investing this domain and acquiring quite an extraordinary expertise. And tying it back to the situation of today is that we're already seeing that some actors share their expertise, for example, with Ukrainian civil society. So this is quite extraordinary.
The response of the Syrian civil society was very rapid in this respect. Perhaps it started with documentation, the documentation of violations. In fact, we have seen the start of projects and organizations emerging since the beginning of the revolution in Syria. In April 2011, the Violations Documentation Center was established, and shortly after, the Syrian Network for Documenting Violations was also established. Later on, a wide and large group of organizations was formed. I think these were the first important steps, establishing the foundations for the following steps and any other work that was basically done. Because of the documentation process, it became possible for us to have statistics, to have studies. At a later stage, we saw the development of the documentation process from its initial form as fact-finding and human rights documentation to a level which complies with the international standards for documentation and leading to investigations and cases. I think this was one of the key steps. Subsequently, there was the process of the self-organization of victims, giving the victims the possibility to communicate, to get together, to establish their own specific initiatives, in addition to leading the advocacy process pertinent to their cases. This was of essence.
Mazen also argues that it is important to document, and he draws the attention to the fact that the massacres in Hama were very much silenced, erased, invisibilized, and there was very little documentation, and even the memorialization of these crimes was violently suppressed. And this left many Syrians, of course, scarred, and they're still haunted by that trauma. And you feel that a lot of people want to avoid that the regime gets away with these policies of erasure and invisibilization.
Yet, there's a huge difference when we compare, for example, the evidence and documentation we had on the massacres and violations that happened in Syria in 1982 with the nature of the documentation and evidence about the violations and massacres that Syrian civil society gathered today. On the other hand, when we talk about alternative media, the Syrian media has contributed to revealing facts and contributed to foregrounding these violations, sometimes even broadcasting them live. All these elements together make us confident that today in Syria we do not have technical problems of access to justice or accountability as much as we have political problems.
the political problems, that's a topic that deserves a podcast on its own, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's really important to bear in mind that the international political stalemate had a huge impact on the justice efforts and enabled impunity. This forced civil society to come up with innovative solutions, like more creative, and claim their place on the international table to weigh in justice efforts in Syria. These are huge achievements, as Maria stressed. She insists on how victims groups show the way forward in this respect.
Keeping the narrative of victims alive, countering the narrative of the Syrian regime and its allies, and also, I would say, keeping the commitment of a human rights alive, because what Syrian civil society have shown its neutrality. So now we have cases against the Syrian regime, but also against other actors. So for me, what the Syrian civil society have done in terms of justice, it's a way for a future Syria that where all crimes are held accountable. The support of victims group to take the lead on the process, for me, it's also very important.
Yeah, rightly so. Maria stresses that Syrian civil society was at the forefront of the struggle for justice and accountability, and also looked into the violations of all the perpetrators. And this is quite important to stress. So we really can't underestimate the importance of this achievement, because accountability, of course, was not prioritized internationally. And there is a shared feeling among Syrian civil society actors that they need to be vigilant. And Mazen also reflects on this fear.
At the political level, I think that Syrians also succeeded in keeping the issue of justice and accountability on the table. I believe that whether the United Nations or the parties to the conflict, or even the regional and international allies, are not primarily concerned with the issue of justice and accountability or with the rights of victims. On the contrary, despite the recurrent rhetoric and the good intentions, we feel that in reality there is an attempt to reach a political agreement that guarantees the interests of the parties to the conflict and their allies without involving the victims and preserving their rights. I think that Syrians succeeded in ensuring that this file is kept on the table and not allowing a political agreement that does not take these issues into consideration.
This brings us to the final question of the perspective on the future. Maria stressed that there is a need to think beyond criminal accountability. There have been huge successes in this domain with the recent universal jurisdiction cases, but let's not forget that justice entails so much more, and that progress also needs to be made with regard to the files of the missing and the detained.
Yes, and both Mazen and Maria alluded to the ongoingness of justice efforts. And unfortunately, we see that the Syrian context is also a laboratory for justice efforts. Because of the failing justice architecture, there is a lot of trial and error going on.
I also think that we need, as victims, as activists, and as civil society, to start moving away from theoretical and ethical issues towards searching for pragmatic solutions. Today, a large part of our work and our struggle in this regard has an ethical dimension. We talk about the necessity of releasing detainees, stopping torture, revealing the fate of the disappeared, accountability, transitional justice, reparations, etc. All these concepts are extremely important, and there is absolutely no doubt they reflect moral values. However, these no longer suffice. We have to engage more in the operational details and imposing the need for long debates and discussions. The recent trials in Europe have shown that we perceive the concept of justice differently. I think it's normal. We are talking about an internal local conflict. It has a sectarian character, a regional character, a complex ethnic character. There is regional and international interference, and a terrorism and extremism aspect. We have all these complications when we talk about justice, when we talk about accountability, about the truth, about fairness and reparations. When addressing all these topics, we need to get out of the theoretical framework and head more into a practical direction. Instead of talking about transitional justice as a theoretical concept using the basic vocabulary, we need to start drafting a transitional justice law so that we can see who should be held accountable, who should be prevented from holding public positions, etc. When we talk about reparation, what do we mean by reparation? Physical or moral? Think of the property situation today, where half of the Syrians' homes have been destroyed and requisitioned. I think we need to dive into all these details practically and operationally.
There is a need for a lot of discussion about all of these details indeed. As Maria indicates, the El Khatib trial triggered some of these discussions, also about the need to look into other justice demands and needs.
Actually, the justice effort now at international level are very much focusing on accountability, which is very important. Yani, we are all asking for accountability. So I think it has been very good in terms of bringing justice for some victims and support or maybe encourage other victims to go toward accountability and use the available mechanisms. The political message also has been very important from all the accountability effort, that hopefully one day all criminals will be held accountable and the Syrian regime will pay for its crime one day. However, I think it's important to think about the limitation of criminal justice process. We need to widen our thought about how many survivors would be able to participate, what justice means to different people, how we can really make justice something that impacts everyday life of people, especially marginalized community in Syria. So I would say we would need to think about how we can protect the victims, support them in a way that they will suffer less from the crimes or build their life. It's an important part of justice. One example about justice is the right to know. Many families were very happy with the Al-Khatib trial. However, they still don't have any information about their beloved one. So the right to know, it's an essential right for the people who have someone who is missed. The right to know where are they, and if they are killed, where the bodies are. That is my perspective on how we need to work more on justice and not only limited to accountability.
Maria underlines here how important it is to ensure that victim groups are also involved in initiatives that go beyond criminal accountability, and that these initiatives really need to be grounded in victims' experiences. Habib, would you want to give us your final perspective before we wrap up?
I think we have covered a lot of ground in this episode. And I think it does introduce a number of topics that we are going to discuss in the following episodes. However, one point I would really like to emphasize here, and that everyone often forgets, is that justice is not only about institutions, about courts, or even about truth commissions or a mechanism to reveal the fate of the disappeared. Justice is also very much about informal initiatives, about non-official efforts that Syrian civil society actors and the Syrian victim movement is conducting. I think this is already part of justice processes, even if it's not fully institutionalized. More importantly, I think it's a way for the Syrians to resist oppression by the Syrian regime and by other actors in the conflict. It's their way to fight back. And this is a very important element of resistance in the story of justice in Syria.
Yes, indeed. It will be really great to look in detail with the next episodes, of course.
In the next episode, we will talk to Patrick Kroeker from ECCHR, human rights lawyer Anwar Al-Bunni, and Veronica Belentani from the NGO SLDP. We will look into the intricacies of criminal accountability, which is, of course, one of the main topics in the current justice debate, because these court cases are raising so many expectations. Yet, as Maria just stressed, they are only a part of the justice efforts, and we should also look into the limitations of criminal accountability. But that's food for thought for the next episode. For now, I really want to thank you, Habib and Artino, to kick off this episode today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I also wanted to thank Marielle Abde and Mazen Darwish for sharing their insights, and Amr Said, who kindly assisted us with the English voiceover. And last but not least, thank you, our listeners. Feel free to add a comment, ask a question via our website, justicevisions.org, and also tune in for the next episode in April.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.
Our listeners, feel free to add a comment, ask a question via our website, justicevisions.org, and also tune in for the next episode in April.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.